Evidence and Answers begins right now.
Thomas Aquinas was a brilliant mind from the 13th century. But what made him one of the most influential apologist, theologian, and philosophers of church history? Stay tuned to learn more about his dynamic ideas about truth, theology, faith, and so much more. You're tuned to Evidence and Answers radio broadcast with our host, Pat Zukran. Pat is an author, teacher, and international speaker in the area of Christian apologetics, the defense of the Christian faith. Today, we will conclude with part three of a discussion Pat and his guest, Dr. Richard Howe, had as they examine Thomas Aquinas. Now, on to our conclusion.
One of the things I discovered in my doctoral research was how seldom commentators on the five ways didn't consider the philosophical context in which he gave those five ways, whatever that philosophical context is. And so I found about maybe a half or more of the resources that I was, when I was looking for this, just totally misunderstood his arguments because they didn't consider what those arguments meant in the context of his broader philosophical view, which he obviously, I started to say obviously, maybe it's not obvious unless someone's actually seen it. These five ways are given right at the beginning of his big multi-volume magnum opus called the Summa Theologia. They're right at the very beginning. So obviously he hasn't spent any time on background assumptions and terminological definitions. And he didn't, because he just, it's like the second thing he brings up, he starts talking about God's existence and then he's off to the races. So it's understandable, I suppose, for some people when they read it so early on in this magnum that they figure they can just take arguments at face value. And I would submit to your viewers and hearers that that can be a fatal mistake. That is fatal in the sense you're going to drastically misunderstand the argument if you don't already know what he obviously assumed his readers already knew in the 13th century. That is, everybody knew Aristotle. Everybody knew Aristotle's four causes, so that when he talks about efficient cause, he doesn't have to define that. And so what I argued, among other things in my dissertation, was, okay, so undoubtedly, he's assuming everybody knows what efficient causality means, though he doesn't define it. He just figures, well, nobody doesn't know Aristotle, do they? I thought, if that's true, then might it be the case that there are other assumptions that he's playing off of and really serve as the context that he doesn't define that might make a difference in how things are understood? And that's what one of the things I argue. And one of those assumptions is his concept of existence. And unless somebody understood what he already thought about what it meant to exist, then to argue for God's existence ultimately won't really have a lot of content. It just kind of seemingly doesn't get you many places. But here's the thing to notice. I'll end with this part. Where that comes in his five pithy little arguments that he gives is at the front end. What happens as soon as he gives those arguments is then an inexorable cascade of all of these classical attributes of God. Starts with simplicity and then goodness, you know, omnipotence, omniscience. They're just downstream from that. And they all stem from that basic starting point on his metaphysics, that the God that he's proving exists is not just like Thor or Zeus or Hermes or any number of gods that people might run into in the Greek pantheon. It's not just some thing out there that we could argue does or does it not exist, like we might argue about UFOs as we're arguing today, or does Santa Claus exist? New people, you know, you could have all these arguments, and then God comes along. Well, what about God? You know, does he exist? And we kind of, some people give these arguments, go, yeah, but when we're talking about God, we're talking about something that's unique, because we're talking about an infinite being whose very essence is to exist and gives existence to all creation. That's what we mean, at least. So that's what he does. And so the first one's called the argument for motion. I lied to you. I told you I'd end with that thought, but just to give, to kind of answer your question. His first one was the argument for motion. Unfortunate English translation. The better word would be change. So when you see a leaf go from green to brown, as Stevie Wonder would have said in his inner visions, I don't know if leaves go to green to brown in some places in the world, but they do in the Southeast U.S., that's called motion in Aristotle. Even though the leaf didn't move, it's not locomotion. It just means change. So you got the argument from motion, the argument from efficient causality, the argument from necessary being, the argument from the graduation of perfection, and the argument from teleology are his five ways in question two of his Summa Theologia, part one, question two.
Yes, and another one pillar you mentioned was his understanding of natural law, which was a tremendous influence later on philosophical and legal traditions. So tell us about the natural law and how that really influenced culture. And you mentioned how much it influenced the writing of the Declaration
Absolutely.
And the Constitution here in the United States.
Absolutely. What a sad commentary it is on the progress or deterioration of jurisprudence in the United States when you go from the Declaration of Independence mm-hmm. to when Clarence Thomas was going through his Senate confirmation hearings. Lawrence Tribe, who was professor of constitutional law at Harvard University and actually wrote and consulted for constitutions in other countries in the world as they're formulating constitutions, he wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times. You know, people old enough, maybe my age, might remember those confirmation hearings, and they were fraught with a lot of controversy and scandal. But probably what most people think they remember were these allegations of sexual misconduct at an earlier government appointment when he was Solicitor General, and the Anita Hill and all those kind of. Lawrence Tribe, though, no fan of Clarence Thomas, in his op-ed said, no, you know what the real controversy was? What got the senators all in a tizzy was the fact that at some point Clarence Thomas said he held the natural law.
Yeah.
And I just go, okay, so all these guys break out in a rash when a potential Supreme Court justice believes in natural law theory, when natural law was our birth.
Right.
That was our birth certificate as Americans. They go, wow, how did we get there? The key, I think, with respect to natural law and morality and human morality is the notion of teleology. So teleology is this idea that given what a thing is, its whatness would be its essence. Given what something is, then it possesses these capacities, or Aristotle's word would be potencies, but these capacities to change in a certain direction towards a certain goal. So a papaya seed is not going to become a whale, no matter how long and you let it. It's never, ever able to become anything other than a papaya tree. That's it. Now, it might fail to do that if it's, you know, burned in a fire or eaten by an animal. It might fail, but left to its own devices, it will inevitably become a full-grown, healthy papaya tree. And that's what it will do. But why? Because it has this nature, its whatness, its essence, that sets it on this trajectory. Well, in Aristotle and then Aquinas later on, any natural object, so we're not talking about artifacts like a cell phone, for example, or a laptop, but any natural object, a dog, a tree, whatever, has a teleology by virtue of its essence and nature. So what constitutes the good of that thing is when it fulfills its sort of purpose, its sort of goal, it reaches that goal that's completely filled. And by the way, just to interrupt myself, one important thing I think for people to bear in mind is when we start having these discussions here about natural law, one of the first things I do when I talk about this subject is to alert the audience. You've got to understand the difference between good and moral good. Mm-hmm. Typically, in my experience, in just conversations, when people use the categories good and evil, they almost always mean moral good. Unless it's obvious, like if they say, well, this pineapple here tastes good, we don't mean it tastes morally good. That doesn't make any sense. What we mean by this pineapple tastes good is that it ought to taste by virtue of being a pineapple. A good knife has the characteristics that it ought to have, not a moral ought, but that it ought to have by virtue of being a knife. It wouldn't make sense for somebody to go, well, that's not a very good knife you're trying to sell me. And I go, well, why do you say that? Well, the blade's all dull and pitted and stuff. And, you know, I said, well, what do you think? Well, I think the knife ought to have a sharp blade. It wouldn't make any sense for me to go, well, who are you to say that a knife ought to have a sharp blade? You're trying to impose your morality on me? You go, no, that's just what it is to be a knife, is to have a sharp blade. It's a bad knife when it has a dull blade. It's a good knife when it has a sharp blade. So if you take that kind of talk And you talk about, well, what is a good, and then fill in the blank of anything that has, that's a natural object. What's a good horse? What's a good lion? What's a good tree? What's a good dog? In every instance, you're basically meaning it has all of its capacities that it ought to have by virtue of the kind of thing that it is. Here is where the story then gets very interesting, because not only in Aristotle, but also in Aquinas and other thinkers as well, there's something different about human beings among all animals. And that is that human beings have rationality and free will. And not free will in necessarily in the sense in which Calvinists and Arminians debate that. They're connected, but they're not exactly the same. This is more of a philosophical notion. I think there's a way to define this that's relatively indifferent to that theological debate in Romans 9 and stuff. What you mean by free will is that a human being has the capacity to deliberate among competing goods, some of which goes against what it is to be a human being. A lion will never not act like a lion unless it's sick or injured. It never won't be a lion. It doesn't identify as a cheetah, whatever, right? Mm-hmm. But a human can act in a way that detracts from what it is to be a good human being. Now, people may go, well, wait a minute. You're sneaking something in here, because who are you to say what a good human being is? And my first reaction to that is, well, first of all, this isn't the first time we've had this conversation as human beings. We've been talking about what is it to be a human being for thousands and thousands of years. Yeah. And people would be startled to see a fairly unified picture of what a good human is. It's a person who's kind. It's a person who's faithful, keeps his promises, doesn't hurt other people. You just go down this list. Everybody recognizes that as a good human. So what makes it moral when we do it is precisely because we have the capacity to not do it or work against that. No other creature on the planet, sensible creatures like a lion or whatever, they don't have that capacity to do anything but what their instinct makes them. But humans are what, to use Aquinas' term, we're provident over our own life. And so we're strapped with this responsibility to try to find out, well, what is it to be a good human and not, and follow a certain trajectory, and we run the risk of doing violence to that. And that's what makes something moral, is that we have that choice. That's why, if some of your viewers and listeners might have already thought this about Aquinas, that's why Aquinas would say, well, God's not a moral being. And people understandably go, well, wait a minute, what? I thought it says God is good. And so, yeah, but what Aquinas means by that is God doesn't have a teleology such that he's trying to be all he can be, and hopefully someday he'll get there. What we're saying is he's the infinite standard of goodness, because he's infinite being itself, to which all my finite being is just trying to approach, you know, as I have a capacity as a zygote in the womb and eventually become a full mature adult. The difference between that zygote and that adult is the amount of being that it took on, that all those potencies become actual. And so that whole thing, then, to the degree that those fall within my will to choose, I mean, I don't choose to digest or go bald, you know, or something that those aren't, but I do choose how to treat my wife or how to treat my friends or how to keep my promise. I do have a responsibility to choose that. So this natural law theory, Aquinas would argue, it's the way God can manage nation states, if you will, in terms of peaceful coexistence, where we can recognize maybe the best way to get along with other nations is not conquer them and take all their stuff, which is what most nations did for most of the history of the world, right? Mm-hmm. But say, how about we have diplomacy? How about we try to get along with borders and our language and stuff and peacefully coexist? And by the way, not to open up a can of worms on a totally different subject, but just to throw this out for people to consider, Robert Riley's book, The Closing of the Muslim Mind, has a great expose of when the Christians in the Middle Ages and the Muslims in the Middle Ages were grappling with how do we understand the relationship of faith and reason, that Christianity, by and large, chose, hey, there's a mutually supportive role that they play. And it opened up Christian Europe to new ideas in science. We went from the Ptolemy to the Copernican model, to new ideas in government, like diplomatic relations rather than warfare, new ideas in economics. Instead of feudalism, we had more of an entrepreneurial and private property. Christian Europe was open to these things because they settled that issue rightly, whereas Sunni Islam basically said, it's the absolute will of Allah, end of the story, don't question it, don't try to do apologists, do that. And it arrested Muslim development, who, a lot of ways, Muslims were the vanguard of societal progress, especially in the Iberian Peninsula and in that period. But it got arrested, and now we're fighting ISIS and stuff because they're still behaving the way most nations behave. Conquer your neighbors and take their stuff. That's what I mean, I'm laughing because this is so obvious. But Briley argues all this boiled down to this idea of faith and reason, and then its ability to open the door to natural law theory, where we could understand moral truths that are objectively true, irrespective of our religion and our language and stuff. So it's gone away in American jurisprudence for the most part. I'm not a lawyer. I didn't go to law school. But from people that I talked to and read, it's almost non-existent there. And I think it's a shame in a way, because this, you know, this legal positivism that whatever is right is just what the law says. God, I don't know, man. I mean, the law used to say slavery was okay. Mm-hmm. And how did we come to terms with the fact that it's not okay? Because there were moral truths that were objective, irrespective of what individual governments prescribed. And so that whole theater of discussion is all the natural law concepts.
Yeah. And one of the things you mentioned, Islam, and something a lot of people may not know is that Aquinas was a great evangelist to the Muslim world. He wrote one of the best defenses against the challenge of Islam. You know, Dr. Geisler said, I believe it was Charles Martel, who militarily defeated the advance of Islam overtaking Europe, and it's Aquinas who intellectually defeated Islam. Tell us about how he did that.
Well, it's interesting. His, you know, I mentioned the Summa Theologiae, which is his magnum opus. It's about six volumes in English translation. But whether that's the most important or not, certainly a close second would be his Summa Contra Gentiles. And basically what that is a manual of apologetics for Christian missionaries. Almost inevitably, they're going to go up against Muslims in their spread of the Christian message. So he meticulously lays out the distinctives of Christianity. Now, there are some things that Muslims and Christians might have agreed on to some extent, in terms of, let's say, the correspondence theory of truth, although that one was up for grabs in some Muslim quarters. So it depends on who you ask. Obviously, the differences that are there are the differences that make all the difference, right? And that's the distinctives of Christianity, the Trinity, the deity of Jesus as God in the flesh, his resurrection, well, his death on the cross, which Muslims deny, and his resurrection from the dead. Of course, if you didn't die on the cross, the resurrection wouldn't even make sense to the Muslims and stuff. So he meticulously lays out. And the thing about the Summa Contra Gentiles, in contrast to, say, the Summa Theologiae, at least in my experience, it's a much easier read, personally. It's shorter, and it's even though it's five volumes and it's fairly modest-sized paperback, I actually worked out a matrix, and I'm a very slow reader. I think God's kept me a slow reader just to be an encouragement to students who worry about the fact that they might be a slow reader, so maybe I shouldn't do apologetics or philosophy. I go, I've got a PhD and somehow pull that off, and I'm a slow reader. Okay, you just have to make the time out to do it. So I worked out a matrix one year to just how much would I need to read every day to get through the Summa Contra Gentiles in a year, and it was a fairly modest amount of reading, and it's divided up in these sections that are very accessible. So I would encourage your viewers and hearers to consider maybe sitting down with the Summa Contra Gentiles, because you get into some of the same issues, because it's the Christian worldview, if I may use that term. It's still that he does in the Summa. He just doesn't cover as many open-ended questions that need to be settled as he does in the Summa Theologiae, which, you know, that there's pretty much no stone left unturned in that work. Okay. But the Summa Contra Gentiles is a great, great read to just go through on issues, the existence of God, the attributes of God, and the distinctives of Christianity with respect to the deity of Christ and his crucifixion and his resurrection. So yeah, good read. Summa Contra Gentiles is what is most commonly called in English translation.
Yes, you've been listening to Dr. Richard Howe, professor of philosophy and apologetics at Southern Evangelical Seminary. We've been talking about one of the great apologists and theologians and philosophers of Christian, but also Western history, the great Thomas Aquinas. Well, Richard, you know, as we bring this to a close, if people want to get a good understanding or introduction to Thomas Aquinas, they're a little intimidated by his works, where can they start?
So the first thing that comes to mind is Geisler's book, Thomas Aquinas, An Evangelical Appraisal. Now, the challenge there is the book is technically out of print, so you still might find it, however, in the used book market. I've heard rumblings that the Norman Geisler International Ministries is going to publish his second edition of that. I haven't heard lately where that's at, so keep on the lookout for that. Another source that I think is great is a Catholic philosopher that I really admire named Edward Fazer. When you see it, it looks like Fesser, F-E-S-E-R, but it's pronounced Fazer like the weapon in Star Trek. Edward Fazer, and it's a book just titled Aquinas, A Beginner's Guide. It's actually a series of small books on this Beginner's Guide series. And Fazer actually wrote the one on Aquinas. He wrote the one on John Locke, and he wrote the one on the philosophy of mind. So I think he's just a tremendous writer and putting the cookies on the bottom shelf. But when you need him to, you know, he can just get as technical as you want. And that one, though, in his little Aquinas book, it's a great summary of Aquinas' thought. So those two things right there, I think, are a great place to start to try to, you know, get your feet under you regarding the thinking of Aquinas.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And also some courses at Southern Evangelical be a great place to start. Tell us
of
about.
Of course. Absolutely.
Yes. Tell us about
That's
Southern.
Right. So SES.edu, Southern Evangelical Seminary, we're top heavy in apologetics and philosophy. This is what Geisler's DNA is. We realize how integral it is to sound theology, particularly existence and attributes of God. A sound philosophy actually is. So our philosophical orientation is unashamedly classical or Thomistic, okay, in terms of its Protestant version, not the theology of Aquinas necessarily, although the theology would comport as well. So SES.edu, we offer classes for degree or non-degree, even audit. For pennies on the dollar, you can get audit. We've implemented some time ago a kind of, I think they call it an equal sacrifice policy. What we try to do is students from other nations try to modify the tuition cost, their exchange rate kind of thing. What would this many American dollars in the U.S. mean and that many this monetary unit in that country? And it makes it more affordable for many countries in the world if a person is, and we do everything, pretty much everything through Zoom. Some classes are live stream. Some classes are what we call asynchronous, which means they're pre-recorded. But even the pre-recorded classes, you still have access to the professor through Zoom. I'm doing a class right now on Thursday nights on atheism. So we've got all different kinds of formats. And we offer not only a bachelor's degree in religion, but we offer a master's in apologetics, a master's in philosophy, a doctorate of ministry, which is a lot of luminaries around the world have those degrees, and then a PhD in philosophy of religion. So if you go to ses.edu, you can get a catalog there. You can get me anytime, rhowe@ses.edu, just my first initial, last name. If I can do anything for you, answer any questions, I'm happy to do that. And then if you want as well, the website that my wife, Rebecca, and I have is richardghowe.com. I told somebody that in a moment of humility, I bought and named a domain on the internet after myself. That's how humble I was. So richardghowe.com. I'm not a web developer. It's a pretty cheesy, static website, but I think the links all work. And I've got tons of resources there that you can get for free. And from anything from multimedia to PDF files and stuff. So I invite you to check that out as well.
Yes, thank you very much. Yes, you've been listening to our interview with Dr. Richard Howe, the Norman Geisler, Chair of Christian Apologetics there at Southern Evangelical, Professor of Philosophy and Apologetics. So Richard, thanks again for being a guest here on—
Thanks, Patrick.
Our time today has come to a close. Be sure to join us again here on Evidence and Answers. Our goal is to bring you the love of Christ and to equip you in your faith to always be ready to give a response. If you would like to hold an apologetics conference or series of teachings at your facility, contact Pat by calling him in Hawaii. That number there is 483-0586. Or email him through the Evidence and Answers website. That's evidenceandanswers.org. Be sure to browse through our listing of topics on our site. We have everything from atheism to Zen Buddhism. You will also find articles and additional audio for you to listen to or download. An additional location to find Pat's messages is on YouTube. Look up Evidence and Answers and hit that subscribe button. To keep quality broadcasts, like Pat's on the Air, we rely on generous financial support from you, our listeners. Donating is simple. Once again, log on at evidenceandanswers.org. Evidence and Answers is grateful for one of our sponsors, the Honolulu Christian Church. If you don't have a home church and are looking for a great place to grow in your faith, check out the Honolulu Christian Church. For service times, log in at honoluluchristian.org. Join us again next time on the air or online as we provide compelling reasons for faith in Christ. That's Evidence and Answers with Pat Zukeran.